across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet by webcast and by podcast. My name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. As ever, thank you for your contacts, your emails, and your messages on my Facebook page, the official Facebook page of The Unexplained with Howard Hughes. The website, of course, is still storming, thanks to Adam, my webmaster. That is theunexplained.tv. Those are the two main portals for The Unexplained. So anything that's happening with the show or to the show, you'll find out about on my official Facebook page or indeed through the website. We've had some really great guests lately, including Chris Hadfield, and thank you very much for your very nice feedback about that. Chris Hadfield was gracious, generous with his time, a wonderful and interesting man who I'd love to speak with again. You know, I spent a long time trying to get Chris Hadfield on this show, and partly with the help of Johnny at Talk Radio, we made that happen, and, you know, it was well worth the wait. And as I say, I hope to speak to this immensely interesting man who's had a fantastic life again. Okay, the guest on this edition of the show is similarly somebody who's had a truly remarkable life that's taken many twists and turns. Marla Freese, you may well have seen on television. You mightn't instantly recall her name, but if you've watched various TV series, including Married with Children, Diagnosis Murder, Everybody Loves Raymond, Marla is in those shows. And she is an accomplished actress, but she is also a medium and a psychic, and she's written her life story. It's been out for a little while now, but it's the first time that she and I will have spoken. It's called American Psychic. It is a remarkable story. We'll work our way through that. And we'll also get her own story about some of the work she's done helping police with their inquiries, also her involvement with secret spies in the U.S. military or around the U.S. military. A truly remarkable life, and a very frank and honest account of it in the book, too. So Marla Freese, the guest on this edition of The Unexplained. As I've said in the last couple of editions, I'm now booking my podcast guests myself again, so life becomes a little more challenging. So any thoughts that you might have about guests I could include, ways to contact them, gratefully received, and I will then keep on top of it. And thank you very much for all of your support for my shows, the online show, and indeed the radio show. And if there's any news about the radio show, by the way, of course, I will tell you on the Facebook page first. You will be the first to know after I know. A lot of debate recently, by the way, about doing the podcast in video. More and more people seem to be using video, and I just think that there is a place in this world still for the spoken word. You know, Art Bell had the occasional little dalliance with video, but only as a kind of CCTV camera in the corner of his studio. Many years ago he did that, and he stopped doing it. I think that the sound of what people has to say is the most important thing. And my own personal view, and it's only a personal view, is that pictures can often detract from it. And thank you very much for all of your emails and thoughts about this, because most of you getting in touch with me feel exactly the same way. You know, sometimes when you're listening to somebody, then you're following what they have to say. Whatever reaction you may have to it is a matter for you and for me. But if you can see where they're sitting, and you're looking at the slanted books on their bookcase, or you're thinking that their hair looks peculiar, or how could they possibly dress like that, or isn't that study that they're sitting in fantastic? By the time you had all of those thoughts, you've lost your train of thought with the words that are being said. And that's why I feel that radio, as we used to call it, sound radio, as people called it many, many, many years ago, and audio podcasts still have their place. And that's why audiobooks sell so incredibly well. I love audiobooks. I love to hear somebody telling their story. You know, it just captivates me. If it's done well, then there is nothing more communicative than the human voice telling a story. And I'm grateful for your thoughts about all of that, because your thoughts seem to be very much the same as mine. So for the moment, The Unexplained continues in the way that I love doing it, and that is simply this intimate conversation between me, a voice in your ears, whatever you're doing, and, you know, you, wherever you happen to be, you know, doing whatever you happen to be doing, as I said. I think that intimacy is something that you can only really achieve by the sound of a voice coming to you from a speaker or into your headphones, which increasingly is the case for many people with their earbuds, including myself. You know, I listen to radio and podcasts as I'm cycling. You know, I find it very, very therapeutic. But I think there is still, in this world of ours, a place for sound and the spoken word. All right, let's get to Los Angeles, California now, an eight-hour time difference between here in London and there. Marla Fries, American Psychic, is here. Marla, thank you very much for coming on my show.
Oh, Howard, I'm so happy to be here.
I understand. I didn't know this, Marla, but in our various communications, you've actually been listening to my podcasts and things. I didn't know that, and it's a great privilege to know that.
Well, thank you. First off, I just want to acknowledge that mellifluous voice that you have, but you're also talented. I particularly enjoyed the Linda Bachman story, and Linda is right in tune with me. I mean, we are people who are trying to move this conversation forward in a different way.
Strange you should say that, because the direction of travel in some of the conversations seems to be going in the direction that we'll be discussing in this conversation, and indeed the direction that I discussed with Linda Bachman. I think there's more acceptance for the fact, as I think it probably is, that what we see is not all there is.
Well, it's not just what you see, it's what you feel. And the knowing that most of us have, I mean, we would not be living on this earth without having knowings inside of us, knowings that came from we don't even know where sometimes.
No, I listen, you're preaching to the converted here, even though I know I have skeptical listeners. My life has been lived, and reading your book today, your life, I think, has been lived too. It's almost been lived on instinct with a little help from somewhere else. And it's the somewhere else that is the great imponderable.
Well, I think that that's a really good point. And it's the someone, someplace, something else that does happen to people. And that's the only way that people who are so skeptical, and as you might have read, I was a huge skeptic about this. So when this began to happen to me in bits and drabs and dribbles, I had to pay attention and I chose to be curious. I chose to not let my ego try to pretend I knew more than I did.
That's a very good place to be in, and you know, not many people can do that effectively. You know, look, people will know your face from television. I was reviewing some of the roles that you've had, and
yes.
I didn't realize you've been in quite this many hot TV shows, including Seinfeld, Married with Children, Diagnosis Murder, Murphy Brown, which I loved, and Everybody Loves Raymond. I've got contact in South Africa who used to stop phone conversations because Everybody Loves Raymond was on.
Well, that's a really great show. And I was so blessed to work with so many of the top people and that in those shows. But you know, one of the interesting things about Everybody Loves Raymond was I had a past life regression with Brian Weiss. Mm-hmm. And I was then cast on this Everybody Loves Raymond, and this woman came out of nowhere, ran up to me, and she said, oh, you have to do your work. And she began to orchestrate by grabbing pieces of paper and putting them on a table. Actually, the identical information that was revealed in my past life regression with Dr. Weiss. It was uncanny. And I mean, she was in her 50s. She didn't look crazy. She was working on the show, but she had this dream. And here I am showing up on set. And here she is coming to tell me and validate a past life regression that I had. So I just kind of got excited as soon as you said Everybody Loves Raymond for numerous reasons.
But look, that's in your working life, and so many of these things have happened around your working life. I have no doubt about any of that. I think many people have strange experiences that we cannot rationally explain, you know, through their way of work. I remember years ago, I went in my formative years. How old was I? I was probably about 24. And I did a turn on a pirate radio station that was anchored on a ship off Tel Aviv, Israel. It was called The Voice of Peace. And the idea was that it was a bunch of British, Australian, New Zealand, Canadian, American guys playing records. You know, I was a journalist, but, you know, playing records. And the mantra was peace. But, you know, we were just playing pop records and all sides were listening to it. But the station had a secretary called Chedva. Hedva Rothstein. I will never forget her. I remember phoning to make the arrangements for my flight and travel to Tel Aviv. And I spoke with her. And I remember saying to my mother, because I was living at home then, I'm sure she's psychic. I don't know why I said that. When I got there, it turned out she was the most amazing psychic. And I lost contact with her, sadly. But she was able to, you know, she had this very loud, clear voice, Mediterranean voice. And she would say, I will tell you what you are thinking. And she could. She could tell people what they were thinking. I've never come across anything like that. So look, cutting a long story short for both of us, the unusual is often part of the usual, I think.
The unusual is part of the unusual is part of the usual. Well, yeah, I guess that's a really lovely way to say that. Let me have a sip of my Yorkshire tea that I decided to make on behalf of my UK friends.
Okay, I'll just talk then. I have a look at the PR copy for, now we know the PR copy is designed to sell and written well. It does. One of the lines from the little news release that goes with your book, American Psychic, says, U.S. military psychic spies, homicide cases, messages from the other side, spiritual healing. Marla Fries was given a gift few receive, and she uses those gifts from spirit to help others. Now, you know, who could fail to be captivated by a line
that? I want to record you for my next commercial. That was fabulous. Yeah, I want to read that book. She sounds fascinating.
And you got a lot of, before we get into the meat of it, you got a lot of great testimonials at the beginning of it. Brian Weiss, who is known to many of my listeners, a New York Times bestselling author, you know, said a powerful and fascinating book. Somebody else here, Marla's Transparency Will Crack You Open, Hold You, and Teach You Why It's Wonderful to Be You, says Abby Levine, Emmy-nominated producer. And the whole string of these things.
Well, I've been fortunate. I no longer work in the acting world. I left in 2002 to actually do this work. But, and I didn't believe in it. To be sure that your listeners understand, I was a skeptic. There were things that happened along the way as in my childhood that showed me some psychic things and let me know that there was something larger than me, some sort of God consciousness. But the dynamic of my life, having been an actress, what really gave me so much connection to such wonderful people. And the acting, I have to tell you, was my survival tactic. In my home as a child, I watched television, you know, we were growing up in the 60s and 70s, and so did my mother, but I had to survive my mother. And if I could maybe get into that television set and become an actress that she respected and loved and laughed at, then maybe she wouldn't hurt me.
You talk in the book vividly about your childhood. You talk about a friend called Valerie who seems to have been part of the escape mechanism. But your mother seems to be a very tough character, and possibly with reason, because, you know, your dad was a World War II vet. Life was, you describe it as chaotic, not easy. So, you know, we always look back and judge our parents differently, you know, when they're not around anymore or when a lot of time has passed. But it wasn't easy for you.
Well, I think that we are the products of our fathers and mothers who were World War II veterans, or in our case, in the States, Vietnam, the Korea War. I called my book, my memoir, American Psychic, because the part of me that is the foundation is that coming into my mother and father's world 13 years after my father had been blown up in a Jeep accident after blowing up Hitler's Siegfried Line. He came back in a body cast. Mm-hmm. And I mean, when you think of 13 years, it's not very long from when there was such trauma. And of course, what did our family members do to medicate themselves from that trauma? They weren't thinking about therapy then. They were thinking about alcohol. And of course, the women were also having difficult times. So between Valium and television and alcohol, you know, and cigarettes, I'm sure that many of us watched our parents navigate that trauma. And we're a part of that. And I think that that is where my heightened sensitivities came in. Have you ever interviewed Bruce Lipton? I didn't check on your list.
I haven't. He's on my list to do. If you have a contact for Bruce Lipton, I would like to.
Well, there are a couple of people, and we'll talk maybe another time about who I think you should have on your show. But Bruce Lipton, you know, he was the Newtonian physicist who was basically teaching that your DNA determines what's going on in your life. That was just the way it was. But he started doing stem cell research and finding out that if you put your cells in different petri dishes with different things to eat, it grows differently. And at a young age, of course, before I knew anything about Bruce Lipton and his biology belief, he realized it was the environment that set the tone for us as children. And I was trying to get out of that environment and get away so that I could change the fears and everything, because there were so many things that happened one right after the other with death and murder and slaughter going on in my hometown, which was so strange. But those elements were the things that helped me understand death. It made me curious. I had to pull myself together and understand that there was a consciousness that was trying to work with all of us. So as scientists, as you know, we're looking at some people with formal education like Bruce Lipton and Tom Campbell, who is an author, physicist, and consciousness expert that I've been working with for the last 10 years, we are understanding that there is absolutely more to all of this.
You talked about your family background, those early years, and how important they were, difficult mm-hmm. at the same time. You say in the book that your mother was tough, and you talked about your father. Quotes, "Mother controlled everything, including my friends. She preferred the girls who came from Bedford's best families, the daughters of successful businessmen and doctors." So she seemed to have a very clear role of, very clear vision of what you needed to be.
Well, that's interesting. I think she was just projecting her own needs and wants. Of course, you know, in her narcissistic world, having her daughters, I have a sister, and her daughters do well, she could laud herself with those accolades. And I think that, I mean, I'm sure that many of your listeners are really hip to this whole conversation. Understanding and having been English, my DNA is French, Huguenot, German, and English. So I am with spatterings around some slave trader ports near Morocco. But we are looking at the DNA, not just of our, you know, our cellular structure. It is actually the emotional DNA. So my mother's unresolved issues were projected onto me. And when my father came back in a body cast, she could no longer be an officer's wife. My father was discharged with 2 bronze stars and a purple heart. So her needs and wants, and everybody's pretty familiar with the fact that parents want that for their children. But my mother did some really incredible things. She had this strange way of knowing things, but she had no way of knowing them. And this is part of the humor that I have around being raised by her. She did have knowings, and I do think that she was psychic. I just think that her fears manifested in such pathology, and that's why she was so abusive.
And when you say abusive, I mean, was she nasty to you? Was every day difficult? Or was it just that it was an almost disciplinarian atmosphere to be brought up in?
Well, I think, Howard, when we talk about abuse, we are more familiar now. Children's abuse can be physical, sexual, spiritual, intellectual. She had a myriad of ways of acting out her rage. And I remember talking to, well, numerous therapists. I've been working with a therapeutic community, not just as a student or a participant or a patient, but as a colleague for, you know, the last 30 some years.
And indeed, this, at one stage, you talk in the book, later in the book, about having to go to a, wanting to go to a psychiatrist. You describe this guy as speaking like Elmer Fudd, but you know, you needed to get to know yourself and your story a little bit more closely, intimately.
I think what happened is when you realize that you've been traumatized, you've got to heal it. There's things that start happening inside the body. I was sick a lot as a child, and I realized when I was away from her, I felt better. So, and when you start to heal the trauma, Howard, this is where all the divinity comes in. This is where I started being more psychic, I was so much more aware of everything. I started to heal the pain and in turn open the door for all of this incredible dynamic of psychic mediumship, you know, past lives, remote viewing, all of these incredible, what most people call paranormal experiences, which I am working to make as normal as possible for myself and others.
So as a child, the psychic side of you that was coming out seems to me to be very much an escape mechanism. You had this friend, Valerie, and I think you would have psychic adventures together. And there was even a stage where a voice, I think it was, prevented you from having a disaster on a runaway horse called Flicker.
Yes.
Your horse.
Yes. Yes, that's exactly right. Well, Valerie, you know, I had a number of friends in my little neighborhood. This is what kids did. They tried to conjure spirits and with Ouija boards and things like that. But that was just a colorful way of talking about, you know, part of life is as a child. But I wasn't particularly interested in that. But what really changed me was when I was 11, getting ready to turn 12 in seventh grade, I was put in front of this darling little girl in the cafeteria. I didn't know a lot of the people because we were all pooled in. The entire county came in 7th through 12th grade, all to be together. And I was in this cafeteria and saw this really sweet little girl. And I ended up sitting with these ladies, these little girls that were from actually a farm area where my father had a hog farm. He was a feed salesman, and he was also a farmer in that way. And we were talking and chatting, and they knew who I was because my father was an award-winning land race hog breeder. And I didn't know these girls, and I just found that they were so wonderful and warm. And this little girl with her wispy hair and her sweet little dirty pocketbook that was sitting on the chair, I just was mesmerized by. It was as though I wanted to protect her, Howard. I wanted to take snapshots. I call them now psychic snapshots, where there's something or someone that is so important that I need to capture something about them. And the next week, she was murdered.
God, how did you cope with that?
Well, I'm actually got very emotional when you just asked me that. I have chills running through my body, remembering that I had just fallen in love with a boy in school for the first time. And I wanted to see him. And that's why I moved away from that lunch table. So when I heard about this, it was completely devastating in that the murder happened near the farm where I had my horse. And I basically started wondering, well, did God save her? Did the angels come? I started being so curious about what happens. What is rape? What happens when someone has a rock in their hand and beats you? I just became obsessed with her death. And I mean, no one grieved. I mean, we didn't know how to handle that back in that time. And now there's still events after 40 some years where basically we do acknowledge her death, but that changed everything for me. It made me start to protect myself from my mother. And then the next year, two women in the same area that owned a diner, and I saw them every week of my life because I was down at the farm so often, and they were both murdered. They were robbed and murdered. And there was just these events. And then the next year, when I was so frightened to even go back down at the farm anymore, my dad convinced me, and I loved my dad dearly, and I would have wanted to have done anything with him. So I went down, got on my horse for this wonderful ride, and things happened that shouldn't have happened on that horse. My hackamore, like the bit, was loose. There was a clap of thunder. I was on a road, and there was actually rain that started happening and semi-trucks to my left, and there was a barbed wire fence to my right. And I kept thinking, okay, she's going to the barn. I'm going to be fine. I couldn't spin her out, which is what we would do with, you know, a horse that's out of control. And I saw the barn and I went, I know that there's this pile of shavings. If she stops, I'll fly right in.
Part of you was expecting a soft landing.
Yes, but it wasn't
going to be that way.
No. In fact, what I heard was, no, there's no shavings. Dig your feet into the stirrups. Hang on. And I didn't know where that voice came from, but it came and it told me that. And I did just that, because when I got to the barn and saw that there were no shavings, I didn't know what was going to happen. And my horse dug her feet in. I flew forward, and my right foot, my right boot, was stuck in the stirrup. And I spun around, I hit my behind on the concrete, and then my head hit the floor. And I remember everything up until that point, because I saw the swallows in the rafters of the barn fly. And I was out. I was out for a day.
But something gave you a warning about that. Can you remember the character of that voice? You know, who do you think
demanding,
that was?
Demanding. Well, at the time, you know, I was a Lutheran, and I was also working with a born-again group, and the whole idea of being saved was a part of my life. And I wondered, was that Jesus? It didn't sound like a man, but it was a voice and a presence that was demanding and loving and basically saved my life.
Right. So there'd been instances in your life where you realized there was something else. Was that the cathartic one that proved to you that there is something beyond here and now?
No. I put that whole experience on a shelf. And I mean, there were intermittent things of a psychic awarenesses that continued to happen. But, you know, that was when I was 14. I had an incident in the early 90s that, of course, I write about all of these things, but it was a dead person who basically warned me that the man that I was engaging with was a con artist. And I thought I was going mad, because I had never had this kind of a voice come to me to warn me that the person who I was engaging with and talking to, I was led to find out that this man was a perpetrator and began to stalk me. And of course, that led me to seeking out help from law enforcement, and I ended up working for them as a psychic.
So you were already, you know, you were doing the TV work then, presumably?
I was working I started working as an actress when I left college.
Right.
I was singing in opera and doing theater in Chicago and Cleveland.
And we all know that when you put yourself out there in the public domain, sometimes the people who are, I mean, most people are fantastic, but sometimes the people who are drawn to you are people that you would not want drawn to you. And this was one of those people. So you're saying that you were given a warning. You were given knowledge that you were engaging in something or engaging in a dialogue that might turn out bad for you.
Well, it was so dramatic. And it wasn't about him seeing me as an actress. That wasn't it. He was looking for people to give these gifts to. And as he was ingratiating himself to people to, I don't know whether it was to get money or to just lure them into his con, but the things that he was giving me, I wouldn't accept. They didn't make me feel right. And I thought, this is so strange. And the voice that was this person was actually the woman who owned those pieces of clothing. He had squatted in her house. She was dead. She and her husband were dead. But he broke into that house and basically was giving away her belongings.
After their death.
After their death. And when I started doing some research on this and found out who owned the house now and talked to the daughter, she said, oh, there wasn't any man that was living there. No, there was somebody that squatted in there and took my parents' belongings. And I was like, oh my God, this is outrageous. And here is this woman named Evie, who was basically dead and talking to me. So Howard, what happened out of that is a series of the most amazing events where I was put in a very famous psychic medium's house. I ended up training with him, and then my whole world changed because I had no reason to become a medium. I was happy selling toothpaste and doing guest star spots on television. I was just amazed at this work. And then, you know, all of these UFO things and all of the amazing travel that I did after that to educate myself in this incredible world. And it was so funny. I was talking to someone yesterday and she asked me, well, what made you leave acting? And I said, well, I was basically called by my agent. She said, why aren't you at that audition? This is a really great part for you. You could have a recurring role. And I said, oh, no, I'm talking to the CEO of Honda, and I'm talking to his dead father. I'm sorry, I can't come in.
And that was it. It was as simple as, well, I say as simple. It was as simple as that.
Well, I left in 2002, but I remember also being on the set when you talk about these television shows. I was on the set of the last show that I did, which was, I believe it was The Drew Carey Show, and it was on the same set with the director of Married with Children. Now, I had shot that early on in my career in the early 90s, and here it was 2001, and the director came by, and he was acknowledging of me and saying, it was really great to work with you again, Marla, and I felt the shift then. I mean, I knew that I was moving out, but I'd come full circle, Howard. I'd had this incredible career as an actress, and this work was so much more important to me. And so I never looked back.
And the media companies, we know what they're like. The media companies that you worked for and the agents that you had, or the agent that you had.
Agents, yes.
Did they think you were crazy?
Well, I thought I was crazy at first. So I really did get a lot of help. And as I mentioned in the book, you know, it was the U.S. military psychic spies that made me feel normal. Mm. But at that point in time, this work, and I ended up working for various private investigators, and when I was working and trained by Lynn Buchanan, I ended up working on cases with the FBI. So there were things that were so much more important in the world. I mean, acting is great, and it's wonderful, and it's fun, and it helped me heal, and it helped bridge, make a bridge between my mother and myself so that there would be some sort of joy at different parts in our life. But no, there was nothing more important than this work.
Reason?
Yes, the only reason to do this work, Howard, is to help somebody else.
Mm. Understood. And that can be the only motivation. I think those who do these things in the hope of aggrandizement, sometimes they get a big shock, I would think. And I think history proves. The book begins, I love the way you dance around the whole story. You know, we go backwards and forwards through your life. But it starts with an experience that you had filming a TV commercial. I think it was for Budweiser. No, it wasn't. It was for cereal. It was for a cereal.
Yes, it was Captain Crunch.
Captain Crunch. Okay, we don't have that over here, but I know what that is. You told your husband in the ad, and you'd never met him before that day, quotes, Mike, I don't know how to say this since we just met, but I'm one of those people who somehow is able to talk with the dead, and I have a guy here called Fred who wants to talk with you. Fred being his father.
Yes, and that's what happened, and it was pretty wild, because what normally was, it still does happen, but I have more control over it now, but my my whole environment when this started happening was I went blind to my present circumstances, Howard. I didn't see the bowl of cereal that I was eating out of. I didn't see the lights, the camera. I saw, this baby's room, this blue baby's room with this mobile gently over top of it. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm in a child's bedroom. And I look into the crib and there's this baby boy. And I started saying, I'm feeling, please tell him it's me, Fred. He said, I know. Please tell him that I know that he reads to his son from the blue book every night. And I just told my fake husband at that time, this is what I'm seeing. This is what I'm feeling. And he said, I do read the rainbow fish to him every night. And he said, I've been so worried and so disappointed and so upset that my father hasn't seen me with this boy. And I said, well, this is why I'm here. I might be able to get some residuals out of this, but this is really why I must be here with you at this time.
So that was the real purpose of the Captain Crunch commercial.
Yeah.
Okay, so there is Mike. He's clearly, as we say in the UK, gobsmacked, stunned at what you were telling
him.
Did you ask yourself, or were you certain in yourself at that point? Did you ask yourself, where did that information come from?
No, I didn't start. I really never questioned where the information came from because it was so definitive. It was so filled with evidence, nothing that I would know of. I mean, still to this day, when I'm working with people, and I work all over the world by phone, I'm transported to somebody's garden and I'm being shown that the dahlias or something that somebody planted aren't growing the way that the mother wanted them to grow, or different pieces of people's information that comes to me that I would know nothing about.
Right. Happen all the time randomly? I mean, can you be standing in Walgreens and this happen?
Well, you know what? I will share with your audience something that happened during the pandemic. I was standing in line going to Trader Joe's, which is a grocery store here in the United States, and we didn't know what to do. We were all standing there with these masks on our face and standing 6 feet apart, and it was the beginning of something that we'd never experienced. And there was this sort of forlorn, very worn guy who was, bless his heart, just looked like he rolled out of bed and had to get food. And there was a little bench right there, and I sat down and I said, it looks like we're going to be here for a while. So he sat, distance apart from me, but we started talking. And he shared about how overwrought he was. He was still dealing with the fact that his two parents had died, both mother and dad, and that his wife was sick. That she was going to have a baby, and that was coming. So the dynamic of the death of his parents and his wife getting ready to have a baby was just overwhelming. And so boom, 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 boom. He opened the door, and I basically said, because he said, I really am thinking about talking to somebody about this. And I said, well, this is who I am. And if you're interested, I do have information for you, because I am sort of English in that way. I do like to ask permission. So it's a boundary issue for me.
You didn't just steam in.
No, I didn't. That's not my style. But a lot of information came in. And it was very, very helpful to him because the baby was then born. He had actually bought the book and was in communication with me. And then the most tragic thing that was going on that he and his wife were dealing with, the baby was born, but his wife was diagnosed with the same cancer that his parents had had.
Oh, no.
So that was quite extraordinary. And we worked together for this last year, and she just passed last week.
Boy. And, look, I don't want to pry too much into that case, into that circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
But you say that you worked together. What were you able to do? I mean, look, I can assume that, the one thing that we all, and I'm sorry, just to here I am talking, and I should be shutting up and listening to you. But
No, we're both talking, so that's good.
I guess the greatest unanswered question is what happens when we die, and you know, is it going to be okay, and will I still know how those I love are doing here?
Yes.
Will I have any input on? So
yes.
I'm guessing,
yes.
but
yes.
it's
yes.
only a layman's guess, right? It's yeah. only a layman's guess that that's what you were doing.
Okay, so this is the work that I do, and I'm not speaking about other psychic mediums, but I'm able to access information about any aspect of someone's life. And I do that with the intention of what is best for them, because it's not a dog and pony show. It literally is. My intention when I work is to help the person. You know, that's what was so interesting about Linda and Backman's work and mine. We both have that similar dynamic when we are working with clients. It's information for them. I am providing information for them, holding the space for them, whatever the information comes in. And when I started working with that young man, it was really to help him heal some of the dynamic with his own mother and father that ended up being so supportive, but also with an illness that had been, you know, besieged his wife. So what we would talk about and the information that I would give him is information for their highest good, whether that was information from a deceased loved one, or it might be information that might be helpful to his wife. So it's not something that is just a panacea. It's a way of helping him be able to listen to mom and dad and talk to consciousness, spirit, whether you want to call it the Holy Spirit or the larger consciousness system, and be able to be there for his wife. And Tom Campbell's work has always been really helpful to me, because here's this physicist scientist who basically had these incredible experiences when he was during the 70s, when he was studying his physics and becoming a physicist. He was one of the men, along with Bob Monroe and an engineer named Dennis Metternich, who developed the Hemisync program at the Monroe Institute. And so Bob tasked Tom Campbell and Dennis with doing the scientific research of what he was putting out at the Monroe Institute. So Tom Campbell was accessing altered states of consciousness without the use of drugs back in the 70s. So here he was becoming this NASA defense guy. And here he is now. He wrote a book called My Big Toe, The Theory of Everything. And I was just in Durham in 2019 when he had 2 weeks of basically teaching people what I can do. This is what I've been fascinated by, helping science-minded, left-brain people understand or be able to access these experiences. Because once you do, that determinism just goes right out the window, because you are actually seeing, hearing, feeling information. You are going into this world where it's information. But the curious thing is that, and I really have experienced this now since the mid-90s, since I've been doing this work for that long, but the information that comes in is deeply rooted in love, because there's no other reason that they come through deceased loved ones, or that I'm able to access that information with them, because they come in talking about life-saving events and critical health issues. And it's about healing generational trauma, Howard.
So are you saying that out there, if we're able to access it, and you say you can, the answers to many of our issues are there. There are souls out there ready. I mean, you know, like they say on those commercials, operators are standing by. You know what I'm saying?
Well, yes. Well,
they're
yes.
standing
well,
by to help.
Yes, it's not just the dead people. Mm-hmm. I mean, science-minded people are doing research all the time, and all of a sudden they get an idea. Boom. Wonder where that idea came from. You know, a lot of people want to take credit for it. It just popped into my head. Who knows where it came from? The fact is, it's there. The fact is that we've been inspired somehow. So it's not just deceased people. Mm-hmm. It's tapping into an elixir of information that has been divined to our consciousness. It's there. Some people call it the Akashic Records. Some people just call it, you know, consciousness.
The real internet. You talk a lot about working with the police.
Yes.
You have a retired detective friend. His name is Steve. And you say in the book, working on homicide cases had become a passion over the years. I offered my psychic mediumship skills pro bono to law enforcement agencies for any kind of case, missing persons, homicides, cold cases, as a way to use my gifts of sight as a community service. And I heard you, this isn't in the book, but I heard you say this on a TV interview that you did in Chicago. You said, and I think this is very telling, it's never about solving the case. It's much broader than that. It's not just about solving the case, which is what, of course, the police are tasked with doing. It's more than that.
Right, it is. And boy, did I, you know, I was on the job training constantly when I was working with detectives. And the point about the pro bono part, that was really a necessity, because at that time, this was in the mid-90s when I was trained with the U.S. military psychic spies, the remote viewers, and then started accessing a lot of information for cases. I was still working as an actress, so I had a lot of money. So I was able to go and work with these detectives. So that's why I kept it pro bono. The way that this is helpful to law enforcement is, any place I would go, any city, any town that I was going to be working in, I would go to the local authorities and say, listen, if you got a cold case, you've got nothing to lose. Let me look at it. And I can see the trajectories of things and various elements that might corroborate what they already have, but also might make them think about some of the old evidence. And I have a couple of great stories in the book about that. But the point is, it isn't John Smith, you know, he did the murder, blah, blah, blah. And it's not about us getting the credit, because oftentimes, you know, the detectives, this is a job for them. This is their work.
And of course, very frequently, both sides of the Atlantic, police don't openly acknowledge the fact that they're using psychics and mediums, but they do. My father was a copper, so I know.
Well, there you go. Exactly. Well, the coppers don't want to talk about us, and that's just fine. But the evidence that is provided usually is helpful. If it's a dead person that comes to me and gives me that information, it usually is because they're still connected to the situation, and they want their loved ones to move forward.
And that's exactly the case. And sorry for jumping in here. I just want to hone in on this. You tell the case of a victim of murder, Janet. And Janet told you, quotes, I was there for days. It took them so long to find me. Please tell my family I'm fine. I don't want them to be upset again. I don't want them to remember me like this.
I got to tell you, there's so much emotion. Even you, with your mellifluous voice, reading that to me, I remember being on the set. We were shooting a television pilot. So they handed me a crime scene photo. I literally walked to where the car was, where she was murdered. I went through that with her, and she gave me information. I was tapping into, doesn't matter, space, time, etc. I went back into that experience back in the 60s, seeing, feeling what was happening to her. And then she basically said, please, please tell my family I'm okay, because that wasn't the way that she wanted to be remembered. But that case was so significant within the area, actually, that it was important that we look at that case. And it's dramatic. You know, it's a great story, and I detail it in the book. But the point about this is, if we can give law enforcement information in a succinct way that won't have them, you know, chasing things down rabbit holes, it can be very effective.
Are you still doing this?
I will. But, you know, all the cases that I can talk about, mm-hmm. I've written about. I also encourage these detectives to utilize some of my techniques so that they can be on top of this themselves. You know, those of us who do this, it is our job to help inform others. That's why I wrote the book. It's not a how-to, it's a memoir. So you go through all of this with me to see all the dumb wackadoody things I do and you know, stupid things that I made poor choices out of, but you see the trajectory and you go on that ride with me, but you also see the evolution of, just as you said, because I know you have had these experiences too. You've had experiences that you can't explain. Mm. And so here you are giving breath and life and wind beneath our wings to help other people see this. And England is one of the most, you know, mediumship places in the world, with Arthur Conan Doyle and all of the people that came out of there.
And these days, the Society for Psychical Research, just returning to Janet.
Exactly.
I mean, maybe you could give me a summary as to how Janet died. And then tell me, once you had got that information from Janet, who presumably knew that she was communicating with you and the message was getting through, when you'd passed that information from Janet to the people who needed to know it, did she go on her path and go away, go to something higher? So first of all, tell me what happened to her, and then what happened to her afterwards when she contacted you.
Okay, well, this was a pilot. This was a television show. So what, and it did not air because it was not picked up as a pilot. There were a number of different psychics working on this, not necessarily the part that I was doing, but we all were doing things in a different way. And what happened was, the point of the show was trying to find out who the perpetrator was, because it was a 30-year-old case. What Janet revealed could be corroborated by law enforcement, but what was not corroborated was some information that happened when I stepped into the evidence room. I basically pointed at things, and all of a sudden something happened that I had really never experienced before, Howard. It was as though I was really tapping into the consciousness of this perpetrator. I took my boots off. I got a little gruff with my voice. And I'm talking to the detective and saying to Michael, the detective, I've never done this before. You've got to interrogate me like I'm the perpetrator. And he did. And what he did and what I did with this consciousness of the perpetrators, we drew a map. And that map seemed to be the places that the perpetrator had also made in the same area. And he divulged some very specific information to help this cold case. And I remember this part, that one of the producers came up and said, "Do you remember when you were pointing at that bag and saying, 'Hey, you've got my DNA in there?'" He said, "Do you know what's in there?" And I said, "No, I'm just listening to what the perp was saying." He said, "It's a piece of the seat where he raped her in the back seat of the car with his semen on it."
So you were literally, by saying DNA, you were absolutely on the money. Dear Lord.
Not knowing what that was. And so here I was, just facilitating this. And I wouldn't... You know, it's funny because there are channelers out there, and there's channelers out there, and, you know, channels that do things like that. But I allowed myself in that situation, and I'm very careful about this because who wants to let their consciousness go away? But I allowed that perpetrator to merge with me.
And that also happens with victims. You tell a story about a victim girl called Carol. And you found yourself in Carol's place. Quotes, "I was hit in the head with something I turned to see in a plaid shirt." The friend of Carol standing there with a large piece of wood. That must have, unless you're able to separate your feelings from this, that must have been absolutely terrifying.
No, it's not terrifying, because you're absolutely right. I am able to separate. It's not as though, I mean, I was Carol at that moment, at that time, but I was Carol delivering information to the investigative reporter, hoping that this guy would be brought to justice. I didn't feel being hit by wood, but I was very clear that that happened. And I was pissed as the deceased person. So she's showing me this. I'm feeling it. And I think that's one of the things about having been traumatized as a child and also becoming an actress. I had my emotions facile to me. And so that's part of what I do in being able to feel all of this. And I try not to use my body in a way that would harm me. It's taken me years to be very definitive about this. But I'm like a Geiger counter for feelings.
That's a lovely way of putting it. A Geiger counter for feelings. And, you know, feelings are, they are a universal, but beyond universal language, I think, as you say, love transcends all things. And I think love is something that comes back to you, I'm sure, with a lot of these people that you contact. You got into remote viewing. Now, that's an interesting step to take. You started at the top because you did that with Lynn Buchanan, who I've had on my show a couple of times.
Oh, good.
And
yes.
These people who'd worked for American government agencies doing this in secret to basically suss out whatever the Soviet Union at the time may have been doing. But you learn from the best.
Yes.
So why, number one, why did you get involved in that? And, you know, how did you use it?
Okay, so for our listeners, the intention that was so heart-centered in me of understanding what this work was about, the prayer that I had, which is an intention to understand what this business about talking to the dead was all about. My intention was heart-centered, heartfelt, and basically a flyer appeared that was basically talking about this U.S. military guy teaching how to look for deceased people. I mean, I don't actually remember the complete definitions of all the stuff that was on the flyer, but I wanted logic here. I mean, this was all happening to me. Remember, I'm the actress that was, you know, a stage actress too, and I want to look at the science of this. I want to look at the reality of this. I want to see the nuts and bolts of how to do this. And if I am continuing to work with law enforcement, I want to know how to do it for everybody, for the victims and to handle the perpetrators and to basically do this with law enforcement so that they can, you know, we can handle this because there has to be healing here. So when this flyer came, it was an answer to a prayer. I went, oh my God, this is exactly what I need. This is when I flew to Tempe, Arizona, and I was there for a large weekend, and boy, oh boy, it was staggering. And I would suggest to anybody who's listening, who is curious about this, there are a couple of darn good remote viewers out there. Of course, Paul Smith, and who was also part of this group, and Lynn Buchanan, and the people that were under him teaching, like Lori Williams. These are people you can work with online, and they're terrific. And, you know, I still play in that arena. I do various methodologies of remote viewing in my own way, but I think it is really helping people understand the subconscious and being able to focus in. And if this, in fact, is an information system where there is a lot of information, then basically requesting, you know, out of that database, hey, I need some of this, and it appears, then that's another way of seeing prayer, isn't it?
How?
Well, I'm saying to the larger consciousness system, hey, I need some help here. I need a teacher. And then boom, one shows up. And it's ones in the book that is kind of a quirky little story. I didn't want to look like my mother. I really thought that she was just so angry and she had a hook at the end of her nose. And I said, one day, I just don't want to look like my mother. But you know what? I need a guru. I need a teacher. That night, making a long story short, my dog sliced the end of my nose off.
Oh my God, Marla.
And then
you may have got the desired outcome, but that's a hell of a way for it to happen.
It's a hell of a way to get some plastic surgery. You know, I had to go into the emergency room and they took a piece from behind my ear and sewed up the bottom of my nose. But then in 2 days, I heard the way that I hear things. Hello, my name is Baba. I want you to eat the ash. and I want you to give you information, and I want you to come to India. I'm like, Baba Ash? And here I am talking to my therapist about this, and she said, Baba Ash? Well, I have some of the ash in my purse. My brother's a devotee of Sai Baba. I'm like, Sai Baba? He was an avatar in India. He has since passed, but that was, I mean, be careful what you ask for, Howard.
Now, you've been very lucky through your life because of what you did. As you said, you made a good living. So, you know, you have a robust bank account. What would you say to anybody
who had?
Okay. No, but what I'm saying is that you had the rocket fuel to start all of this.
Yes.
So what would you say to anybody who feels that they may have some abilities and they want to develop them, but they don't have quite the ability that you had to be able to go to the source for things like the remote viewing? You know, you went to Lynn Buchanan, and you know, you were lucky, you knew people like James, and know people like James Van Praagh, John Edward.
Well, you have to understand, I was literally put in James Van Praagh's house. I did not know him. I didn't know anything about him.
That was the psychic you told me about at the beginning, in whose house
exactly.
You were put. I got you.
That's exactly right. I saw him on television. I mean, I was being stalked. The blinds were pulled, and here's this guy on TV, and I'm like, I had so much attitude about James. Oh, what is this? This has got to be a crock. People talking to dead people. And then my girlfriend calls me and says, I can't get together with you this weekend. I'm going to go see James Van Praagh. I said, is that the short guy with the mustache and blue eyes? She goes, yeah. Yeah. So I went to see him with this, you know, sort of attitude of, yeah, come on, you know, prove it to me, that kind of thing. And oh my God, I was so moved. I came home and got down on my hands and knees and prayed and said, what is this? Show me what this is. And basically, to make a long story short, within a day, I was in his house. Long story. But that part of my life opened up. And yes, I didn't know any of these people. These all came to me. The flyer came to me. I opened the door, Howard. I was a willing participant. I didn't want to be skeptical. I thought that this was so amazing. I had had my skepticism blown apart.
Okay.
And so when you ask, what would you tell somebody? How would you encourage them? I would say, look, if you are feeling guided and led, you will be led to the right people. You will be led to pick up a book. You will be led to watch television shows like, you know, Gaia, and see various people who do the same kind of work that I do. You might want to go to a class. You might want to just be curious. And that's the most important thing that I can say. Just be curious. It's great to be skeptical. I think a healthy skepticism, and all through this, even with UFOs and all of that, I was highly skeptical of all of that. Sitting with Brian Weiss on a cruise to Ensenada, Mexico, I was really a skeptic. And I said, oh my God, every time I hear somebody talking about a past life, they're Cleopatra. And he said, you know, Marla, I have so much experience to back this up. So I listened to a professional. It's the people like we were talking about with Dr. Backman. It's the people who are now having these incredible, you know, formal research that are looking at this, knowing that they can't deny this anymore. I mean, Brian gave up his whole practice to do this work. He was at Columbia, you know, and Mount Sinai, all of it, whatever those things were that Brian was doing at the time, years and years ago. I don't have his credentials right in front of me. I just know he changed my life. That work did. So I'd like to see you in a class, Howard, and then we're going to have another discussion.
Where do the UFOs come into it? You know, I've talked to many people who've said that they are mediums and, you know, they do psychic work, and some of them might dabble their toes into things like remote viewing or dowsing, which is very close and related. Not really the UFOs, though. So how do you square extraterrestrials, UFOs, and all the rest of it with the other things that you do?
Well, Howard, it's just like anything else. I was a skeptic. I was like, we were being taken out in a van in the middle of Sedona, and I had bought all of this gear. It was really cold. It was November, and we were out in the middle of the desert, and I was like, I better see some critters out there because I bought all this gear. I don't want it to go to waste. And I get out there, and it was really quite interesting. We were entertained by these little clouds that started forming in the sky. And the guy that was doing the tour handed me, I think it was a Russian night vision number 2 or something, little telescope that I held up to my eye. And I looked and I saw this thing, and I literally scratched the telescope to see on the lens to see if somebody had put like a cutout version of a little saucer, because that's exactly what I was seeing, the dome, the skirt. And it was just sitting there. And I'm like talking, going, oh my God. And the guy's saying, yeah, that's a gull wing. I said, gull wing? It's a freaking flying saucer, dude. And then I looked back and it flipped, Howard. It was mooning me. It wanted me to see its underside. And
that's the first time anybody's ever said that to me. I was mooned by a UFO. Well, do you think that there is a connection between the spirits of the departed and the other side and the UFOs? Do you think that they may be a manifestation of something similar, or have you just been blessed with being able to be involved in lots of different things and experiencing a UFO that makes its presence aware by mooning at you? That's just something different. What do you think?
Well, I look at it as being all parts of consciousness that is showing up in different ways. You know, crop circles are something that we just can't explain. And I would love to come back over there and go to Wiltshire and see some of that amazing experience of crop circles. I've been involved in, I haven't really gone public with this yet, but there is a process that I've been involved in with taking photographs that my partner and I have amassed 6 to 7 terabytes. So we have information that consciousness seems to be organizing itself, Howard. It organizes itself in ways to help us grow up, to expand our ways of thinking. What better way to expand our nature and idea about the cosmos, but by thinking about it, by being curious about it, by wanting to interact with something, whether there were little critters in there or not, we are still engaging in something that we can't explain, an unidentified flying object, an unidentified object from underneath the water. All of these aspects are things that make us move our consciousness and hopefully, my God, hopefully our humanity forward.
Well, hopefully. Where do the photographs, the 3 terabytes of photographs come into that?
I don't know when we're going to release those. Might be the end of the year.
What sorts of things are on the pictures?
Well, interesting. We have been taking photographs of light and the photographs of stars and planets. And in that, there is something that happens with the particular way that my partner has developed in taking photographs that seems that consciousness designs itself in very unique ways. And that's all I can say about it at this time. I'll have to come back and talk to you more about it.
Well, now that's left me with more questions. More questions than it answers. Marla, it's been a fascinating ride. One thing that struck me about the book, which I speed read today, which is a thing that journalists do when they don't have enough time, when they're time poor, which I definitely am. But I loved what I read. You're very frank about everything. You go into detail about all kinds of aspects of your life. And I got the feeling that for you to be able to do that, it was cathartic for you.
Well, I think that telling the truth, and I remember Oprah saying it, I think at one of those award shows, she said that telling the truth or telling your stories is one of the greatest things that we can do for ourselves. When you have been abused as a child, you have to find a way to help someone else. And by my telling my story, and there are some things that are graphic and fairly in detail, it is to mitigate the secret around it so that, yes, it was cathartic, but being able to tell the truth made me understand and share with those who are trauma experts the fact that hypersensitivity that comes from abuse, physical or sexual or emotional abuse, that hypersensitivity is a strange gift that we must come forward and understand because it opens the door for awareness. It's something not to be medicated. It's not something to, you know, be dumbed down. In fact, I think one of the major reasons that this even happened to me, that if I chose parts of this life, that I had that trauma so that I might open myself to the experience of being so hypersensitive, do the healing around that, because there are many empaths that are walking around Howard that have not done necessarily the work to give themselves boundaries. And if I can be a voice for that, then terrific.
But of course, you would wish if you had your life again, and you know, for all of us, that may well be coming around again, but if you had your life again, you wouldn't have chosen a path that included trauma and suffering. Who would?
Well, it's okay. So here's a little excerpt about this that I really experienced from going to the Monroe Institute and having experience after experience and having past life regressions. It is my experience in doing this work and becoming very facile, going in and getting that information and reliving it. It's something that you talked about with Linda Bachman. It is the essence of that that we retain in that consciousness part, that soul, that higher self that many people talk about, that makes us better people. We don't just forget about what has happened to us because so many people are suffering. It is in the suffering that makes us human. It is in understanding, and I have an experience back in Germany, or whether I was in Poland or not, but I was strapped down to a table, and the doctor said, I'm going to give you something. I was a young Jewish girl, couldn't have been more than 12 years old. I'm going to give you something that's going to help you, hurt you, or make or kill you. And I watch myself leave my body, and I became the doctor. I became the nurse. I was me. I could feel everybody's emotions. And I remember saying as I'm leaving my body, your hate will not destroy my love.
And that you saw and experienced, you think that was one of the appalling crimes of the Nazis during World War II?
Well, it was something that was happening to a past life of mine. So being able to, I mean, if what we believe is and have been experiencing with these past lives is really quite extraordinary. And there's some people that can basically go back and find themselves. But I was on this ride, so I was doing this and just becoming very facile at it to understand that this was real. And it was real to me. And, you know, as your friend, Dr. Bachman said, there are things, and Brian Weiss details this in many of his 9 books, that some of the physical manifestations that were going on inside of our bodies shifted because we had an awareness of that past life. We brought it to the surface and poof, we healed it.
Marla, we're out of time. I enjoyed your book, Read as a Speed Read. I'm going to go back through it and read the detail of it. You're very frank. You're very honest. It's a fascinating story. We've only skimmed the surface of it, so if people want to know the details of it, then they need to get American Psychic, or indeed the audiobook version that I haven't had a chance to listen to yet, but want to. Thank you for giving me your time.
Oh, Howard, it's been my pleasure. Thank you all so very much.
Marla Fries, American Psychic. Your thoughts on her gratefully received. You can go to my website, theunexplained.tv, follow the link and send me an email from there. I thought she was an amazing guest with a remarkable life story. More great guests in the pipeline here at the home of The Unexplained. So until next we meet here online, please, whatever you do, stay safe, stay calm, and above all else, please stay in touch. Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.